This is case number 57689. If appellants are ready to proceed, please do so. This is Merrill versus VREO 15 LLC. Mr. Klausner.
Thank you, Mayor. May it please the court, my name is Jack Klausner. I represent the appellants. I'd like to talk about two areas where I think the trial court clearly committed error. The first one was the finding that an event of default was the failure to meet the valuation condition in paragraph 3.1S, and that there was no notice required. The section 3.1S is extremely ambiguous. It's one of those situations where we real estate lawyers, instead of having all the documents on our computers, have to write up something new. And this was something new to this deal. Interestingly, if you look at the findings of fact and contrast it, there's a typo actually in the finding of fact. The courts took out a period, and I think when this was written or dictated, I think the typist, I'd like to say a secretary, put a period in the wrong spot. And so the language says that there's an event of default. If the valuation condition is not met, that's a material default, an event of default, and anything here to the contrary notwithstanding, period. And there's a period there in the documents.
Was that addressed at all in the order that denied the motion to amend and clarify findings of fact and conclusion of law?
This had nothing to do with that motion to amend, which was the other side.
But still, that was not brought back to the court.
No, it was not. It was not. But if, I'll tell you when I noticed it. When I was sitting over here and looked at the judge's order and said, my goodness, because I was always going to say, the way it's written, the way it really is wrong, in my opinion. I wouldn't say it makes it confusing, because normally we would start the next sentence with anything to the contrary notwithstanding. So we have an ambiguity as written. As it's exactly written, there's an event of default if the lender doesn't get its appraisal in 90 days. The lender was getting its own appraisal. If it didn't get them in 90 days, that was an event of default. The end. Anything to the contrary notwithstanding. I suggest to you that what the intent was, and I think when we go into construction, the first thing I'd like to say, rule of construction, one, when it's ambiguous, it's against the drafter. I like to say that. Number two, you try and find the intent of the parties. I think the intent of the parties was, if the valuation opinion does not come in high enough, we'll give you time to put in substitute collateral. So it's not an event of default. And I suggest to you that the way the parties interpreted the contract gives us an insight how it was supposed to be interpreted. So how did they intend it to operate? Well, first of all, the lender gave a notice of default. They're arguing to you that there was no need to give one, but they did give one. They just didn't give appropriate time. Secondly, Mr. Stubbs, the lender's representative, admitted that this was a non-monetary default that required a 30-day notice, and they didn't give it. And finally, if I can suggest to you, it makes no sense to interpret it otherwise, because you get into too many situations with the ambiguity. For example, let's suppose the valuation comes in low, the borrower comes back and says, well, I'm too low by $1 million, let me give you this property that's worth $1 million. Well, then something has to happen. The lender has to say, well, I like it or I don't like it, we have to go through appraisals, we have to do this. Are we going to get that done in 60 days? And if we don't, do we give you notice? In fact, what happened here, if you count off days, 90 days, by the way, I'll say one other thing. if you or I were writing it, we would say you get 60 days from the date of the valuation, not 90. But I think what happened here is 90 days from the closing would have been about March 17th. The testimony was the appraisal actually came in January. If there's 60 days from March 17th, we're into May. That's when the end of the 60 days is. And yet we're talking in October about substitute property. So you really can't fall into the, there's an absolute default in March, there's an absolute default in May. There's at some point somebody has to give notice. And that's what Mr. Stubbs said. So to interpret this language, I think you have to say, I think when you look at the whole contract, you have to say it required at least a 30 days notice. That being the case, you can't establish the default as of October 30th, and you can't say default interest starts to run from then. All your calculations are off, and the findings fail.
Didn't your client, though, decline to put up any additional collateral?
My client suggested it was not going to put up collateral. And then you get into interesting theories on anticipatory breach, whether you have to give a notice or not. What's interesting, Your Honor, is that that suggestion that it was not going to put up additional collateral signified to them to give notice. But it wasn't a 30-day notice. It was about a 9-day notice, which would be appropriate for a monetary default. The suggestion that maybe there was a monetary default, well, that was not the finding of the court anyway. The court did not find. The court found that the failure to meet the valuation condition was the event of default. Mm-hmm. Sorry. Also want to talk about the determination of fair market value, because candidly, if Mr. Nathan had not testified and Mr. Griggs said $5,000 an acre and Mr. Paulus said $9,000 acre and the judge said, I'm going with Mr. Gregg completely, I'd have no basis to be here talking to you about it. But when she expressly relied on Mr. Nathan's testimony of post-trustee sale matters, and especially the effect of the development agreement, she really told you, I'm doing things that I'm not supposed to do, that the cases say, I'm talking about things that happened a year after the trustee sale, and I'm not supposed to be doing that. And yet she basically said, not I reject Mr. Paulus and I accept Mr. Gregg, but based upon Mr. Nathan's testimony, I see that as tilting everything to Mr. Gregg. That's inappropriate under the case law. So it is our opinion that those were two obvious failures that that require a reversal. I'd like to talk briefly, if I may, about what we call the credibility standard. When the umpire tells me if it's not right over the plate, I'm not calling it a strike. If it's not exactly there, it's a strike. And then he calls me out on a pitch that's 4 inches outside, then I kind of say, that's not fair. You got to kind of tell me the rules beforehand. I watch the Little League World Series every year, and the umpires call everything that's, I say, my God, the kid couldn't reach that with his bat. But they call it for everybody, and they all know it. So, okay, we're playing the field. We went into this basically saying, I originally was the one that talked to Judge Gonzalez about the motion to strike, and it was not a question. She said they can have somebody testify, and I said, but if they're not sure, then they have a problem. And her response was, there are issues. And it wasn't that she was disagreeing with me. She absolutely agreed with me. Yeah, they have issues. Well, what happened is Mr. Stubbs got on the stand, and he testified, everything's green. And Ms. Connor cross-examined him, and he said, well, maybe it's red. And then he then the new lawyer came in and said, isn't it really green? He said, yeah, I guess it's green. That's not a sure thing. And when you read his testimony, of all the, where you are, I hope your clerks read his testimony, it clearly is unsure. And that was the credibility standard. So, now, my wife warns me all the time that oral argument is for the benefit of the court and not because I enjoy talking. So if the court has any questions, I'd be glad to try and respond. If not, I'd reserve any remaining time I have.
The case, the Supreme Court case of Walters versus District Court, does that have any bearing on this case at all, in your opinion?
No.
Okay.
Thank you.
Should have brought a cart.
Good morning, Justice Douglas, Justice Perigari, Justice Gibbons. It's an honor and a pleasure to appear before you today. I represent the appellant and cross-appellant, VREO, Roman numeral 14, LLC, which was referred to below and in my briefs as Vestin, and I'd like to refer to my client that way for clarity. The defendants below I've referred to as Merrill, because that's the major guarantor's last name, as well as a name that's affiliated with his various developments. The crux of this appeal is that appellate claims that the district court did not properly weigh the evidence. And there are two ways that they try to turn that simple attempting to re-weigh the evidence into an issue for this court. First, they claim that Judge Gonzalez should not have considered evidence of things that occurred at any time after the foreclosure sale. Now, first of all, we know that that's not the legal standard, because Unruh tells us that the court may consider all relevant evidence, including the marketing and sale of the property after the foreclosure sale. In this case, there were three types of such evidence. There were the two contracts for this very property. One entered into a little over 3 months after the foreclosure sale, and one a little over 6 months after the foreclosure sale, which did not close. Those were admitted by stipulation of the parties. Those were exhibits admitted by stipulation. There was also a great deal of evidence that I solicited, both on direct of our witnesses and on cross of Mr. Paulus, Merrill's appraiser, that established certain events that happened with regard to this property, other property within the very same development, and that was admitted without objection. And then the third type of evidence is the evidence that Mr. Paulus gave on direct by Merrill's counsel. And that was with regard to a post-foreclosure sale of other property in the city of Casa Grande affiliated with another of Mr. Merrill's developments. All of this evidence was admitted either by stipulation, without objection, or by the defendants themselves and their expert. When I pointed out that in order to base an appeal on such a claim, you must object before the trial court, the response was, well, this is a bench trial, and it being a bench trial, we shouldn't have to object because the district court should know, even if there's evidence admitted, she should go through it and decide what she should and should not rely on. Your Honors, this is the evidence that was before the judge. The idea that Judge Gonzalez should take evidence that was admitted by stipulation and without objection and by the defendants and say, wait, I'm not going to consider that because I've decided arbitrarily, in contravention of Unruh, anything that happened the second after the foreclosure sale, I'm not going to consider. That's not the law, and it shouldn't be. Particularly in this case, because Mr. Paulus, Merrill's appraiser, testified that in order to achieve the Unruh standard, in order to find out what the property would sell for by a willing seller to a willing buyer, it would take up to 24 months after a sale to market the property. He testified of his own knowledge that he had spoken to the owner, the defendants, and that they had not marketed the property one iota prior to the foreclosure. All of the evidence that was admitted by stipulation, by consent, was within that period. The defendant's own expert testified you would have to try to sell the property in order to generate cash because, you know, an appraisal and a check aren't the same. And this court previously has held that the trial court has wide discretion to determine what's relevant in valuing the property. This isn't a house in a tract where you might have a house next door or down the street selling the day after or the day before the sale. This is a process by which experts take sales which are not the same, which are different in time, which are different in location, and different in other attributes, and try to extrapolate what maybe you could sell property for.
Okay, so just to summarize your argument, if I understand it correctly, although the statute says that you consider the fair market value of the property as of the date of the trustee's sale, which was July 23, 2009, the parties stipulated to put in additional evidence of this post-trustee sale activity, that is the marketing and so on and so forth. So that's why you felt it was okay for the judge to consider those factors.
Right. I think it for two reasons. One, obviously, because there was no objection, because the evidence came in and appropriately it was inconsidered. But secondly, even if there had been an objection that was overruled, because under the specific facts of this case, we know that in order to convert the dirt into dollars, it takes up to 24 months. It was well within the court's discretion in this case to admit evidence, in this case, within a 12-month period after the foreclosure sale. This is particularly true when Mr. Paulus was solicited as to information regarding the Merrill Ranch estate sale, which occurred after the foreclosure sale on his direct. In addition, looking at the findings of fact, the way that the court calculated value was that she found our appraiser to be more credible. And in the answering brief, I go through some of the myriad of reasons that Mr. Paulus was not credible, and the things that were pointed out in cross-examination of Mr. Paulus, and I think it makes an interesting read. But what the court did was they accepted the comparables of my appraiser with one exception. She agreed with Mr. Paulus that one of the comparables should be adjusted and increase the value from the $13 million my appraiser testified to just over $13.6 million. She performed that math. I think this is an incredible exercise of exactly the weighing of facts and credibility that our trial court judges and our business court judges do and need to be able to do. And the judge found that the testimony of Mr. Gregg, my appraiser, was more credible by virtue of looking at the line, what happened before the sale, at the sale, and after the sale. That and works. That only makes sense. That's logical.
Yeah.
But she found that it was not determinative, and those are the words that she used.
You heard the comments of counsel as to credibility and the answers or inconsistency in answers, not being sure. Any comment as to that?
Three things. There was no heightened standard of proof established by the district court judge, the colloquy, where she said that both parties would have difficulty getting things into evidence that were produced late. And
allowed the testimony as
well. She said, but you can prove how much you owe by testimony. And then there was a soliloquy with counsel. Well, what if the testimony is not good? Well, then there'd be issues. That's it. There's no additional standard. Secondly, all of the evidence with regard to the amount of the debt was submitted by Dustin. He had submitted no evidence whatsoever. Third, the documents which were stipulated into evidence included the mathematical calculations from the initiation of the loan until the date of default. And Mr. Stubbs, on redirect, was handed a calculator, as Judge Gonzalez had, and she refers a couple of places in the record as to checking her math and if her math is correct, and went through from the day of the loan forward how the interest was calculated, how much was due, and confirmed that the interest reserve credited matched the fact that the last two payments shown on a September 08 chart assumed that October and November payments would be made when in fact they weren't. So that's my response on that point. And then on the issue with regard to the interpretation of the contract, Your Honors, this is very reminiscent of the appeal. Now they're raising issues in oral argument that weren't raised at the appeal. I guess just as Judge Gonzalez shouldn't have to have an objection to figure out what the issues are, we don't need to brief on appeal what the issues are here because, you know, there's three of you. You must be three times as capable of Judge Gonzalez I was going through the entire record and deciding what should and shouldn't.
What about these dates that counsel was arguing that the notices defaults were improper because they didn't get the correct time on the notices? And all.
I very much appreciate the opportunity to address that. On cross-examination, my client was asked about the default provisions of the agreement, 11.1. And he testified, I'm looking at it, it says this much notice for monetary default, this much notice for non-monetary default. On redirect, we went back to the provisions of subsection S, and the provisions of subsection S are very clear. And the sentence in question says, the lender shall receive within 90 days after the closing date of the loan an acceptable appraisal of the property, which reflects the FMV requirement, and the failure of such condition to occur within such 90-day period shall be deemed a material breach and event of default under this agreement. What that triggers, in addition to being a capital E, capital D event of default, notwithstanding any provision herein to the contrary, exact quote from subsection S, in addition, it creates a situation where my client is no longer required to fund the interest reserves. So in addition to that being an event of default, there was a failure to make the payment due on the 25th of the month. And in response to that failure, a notice of default was sent that gave the five-day notice for the monetary default, establishing an additional default. And Mr. Stubbs testified there was a default in terms of the FMV requirement, there was a default in a monetary default, and there was a default in that a bankruptcy was filed, all defaults under the agreement. Your Honors, Mr. Stubbs also testified that he spoke with the defendant, that this loan was fairly unique because the borrower wanted to close the loan very quickly without a current appraisal, and they agreed up front. And Your Honor, I do want to point out to you Section 15F of the agreement, which says we're both very sophisticated and you don't interpret this contract according to who might have drafted it. But they decided up front that I know I need a new appraisal, I'll get a new appraisal, it'll be given to you within 90 days, it will show that the value meets the loan-to-value ratio we've decided on, and if not, I will pledge additional property. They specified which property. I'll get an appraisal of that property and pledge enough of it to make up the difference. When the appraisal came in, Mr. Stubbs talked to them, and this is his testimony. And they said, yes, of course, we will pledge the additional property. Vesson went to the trouble of drafting all of the documents to do that through counsel and presented them for signature. And when Mr. Stubbs called the follow-up, they said, oh, things aren't going very well. We're not going to pledge the additional property. We're filing bankruptcy instead. Clearly, there was a default.
Ms. Carline, what evidence was submitted at the trial to show that interest was calculated from July 23, 09, I guess the date of the trustee's sale, through December 30, 2010, at the default rate of 21%. Was that, our understanding is that's a dispute if those calculations were submitted to
you. Your Honor, Exhibit 12 sets forth the calculation for a period of time at the default rate, but until the judge determined the amount of the deficiency, which she did simply by taking the principal and interest and subtracting the fair market value, until we had that number, you couldn't perform a mathematical calculation according to the judge's finding to see what that interest was. But I want to shortcut this. My client has authorized me to withdraw the cross appeal in the hopes of expediting the finality of the judgment so that we may seek to exercise our collection rights in other states.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Though I graciously accept the offer. I hate to repeat this, but I don't care that much what Mr. Stubbs, how he interprets documents. I want you to interpret the document. I want the court to interpret it. This paragraph is ambiguous. It's clearly ambiguous, and it clearly is punctuation issues. So then you go to the rules on how do you interpret it, and rule number one I like to say is you construe it against the lender. And I'd like to stop there, but I'm giving you a better way, which is what was the intention of the parties.
Was there a provision contrary to that contained in the agreement, assuming they were both sophisticated parties? I thought I heard counsel indicate something to that effect.
I I didn't hear that. I tell you that nowadays we write everything and we say that both parties agreed together. And I will tell you that in Arizona, the rule is not the drafter, but the rule is try to determine the intention of the parties. So even if you fall back to that, you try and say, how did they react? Well, they reacted as if there was a notice requirement because they gave notice. They also reacted as if there was not an absolute default upon the failure of the valuation condition, but there was a anything herein to the contrary notwithstanding went with the second section, which is you can come up with additional collateral. When you don't, then you go into the is there notice? And I think Mr. Stubbs told you, yeah, we had to give notice. That's what he thought. So that was the intention. I'm not saying that's what the document says, because I think the documents are ambiguous. But I think they interpret it as A.
And that was all brought before the district court, and that was an argument you made below?
I wasn't there below, but Ms. Cotter made those arguments.
So it was or wasn't?
I believe it was made, yes. She's saying it was made in some transcripts, and I know it's in the appellate briefs. And the point was, and we're trying to fool around and say, well, then there was a monetary default. With all kinds of evidence whether the, first of all, the interest, the lender had the money and funded it long before. What it did is each 3 months, it took out 3 months' interest and basically said, we now have 3 months' interest. We're charging you interest on that additional advance. But the court didn't go there. The court said the default was the failure to meet the valuation condition. That's October 30th.
Most of them on other bases didn't say inter alia. There were other bases for a default besides just that one.
Mr. Stubbs said, well, yeah, I guess that's what it means, but that's not what the judge found either. The court didn't find that. I can say to you, I think there was another default. I think when eventually the borrower filed bankruptcy, that is a non-notice default, and that would have started. But I can't tell you from the record what day that was, and it wasn't before, I don't think it was before October 30th. So we have certainly a miscalculation on when we're getting default interest. It just wasn't, they failed to give the documents they needed. They should have gotten summary judgment if they had produced the documents they were supposed to do in accordance with the rules. They didn't do it. So they were then set back by Mr. Stubbs, or someone's got to testify, and he's got to do it from his knowledge, and he's got to be sure, and he wasn't. And so what happens is we're told, here's the rules for the game. Play the game according to these rules. We did, and then the judge kind of switched the rules on us, and that's what I'm saying. If there's nothing else, I've saved you a minute for each of your lives. Have a wonderful day.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Thank you, Council, for the arguments this morning. This matter will stand submitted. We're in recess till 11:30.